is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehi Suhili in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
This is very unfortunate. It doesn't speak well of us as a country. It doesn't speak well of us as a nation that really knows what we are doing. Our lack of seriousness in the way we manage our security. For goodness sake, these are our school children.
That was Dr. Abubakar Sani, a public affairs analyst in Nigeria, on the last mass kidnappings of school children in the country. Details coming up also. COVID-19 vaccinations are kicking off in South Africa, and residents are cautiously optimistic about the UN-sponsored Libyan political dialogue. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Gunmen abducted students and staff before dawn today at a government science secondary school in north central Nigeria. The incident at Kagara, Niger State, comes after 300 students of a science secondary school were snatched in northwest Nigeria. The governor of Niger State, Abubakar Sani Bello, said gunmen snatched 27 students, 3 staff and 12 family members at 2 a.m. Wednesday. President Muhammadu Buhari directed security operatives to rescue them. Dr. Abubakar Sani is a public affairs analyst based in Maiduguri, northeast Nigeria. He spoke with reporter Mike Mbonye about the abductions. He says the government should impose measures to prevent future abductions and strengthen security.
This is very unfortunate. It doesn't speak well of us as a country. It doesn't speak well of us as a nation that really knows what we are doing. Our lack of seriousness in the way we manage our security. For goodness sake, these are school children. They are in their schools trying to learn. And if you factor in this very point, the northern part of the country is lagging behind in terms of education. So the few that are even trying to go to school to acquire an education, you are now discouraging them by kidnapping them. It doesn't speak well of us. And I think the government needs to wake up. And I think they should declare a state of emergency in this area of security for students.
This trend started with the Chibok girls in Borno State to Katsina State and now Niger State. What should be done to check it?
It started with the government girls secondary school, Chibok. And most people know, even though the government will deny it, the DSS end up facilitating, you know, ransom payment to the group that abducted the GSS Chibok girls. I think it was a very big amount of money. It was a very big amount of money. $2 million or €2 million was given to them by was it Red Cross or so. Now, this is a motivation. It gave a signal to other groups that we can make use of this very kidnap to make money. And it didn't take long. We had about similar thing happening in Dapchi. There are many others that have been kidnapped, but because, you know, cases are just low-profile people, we don't even hear about them. Then recently, the one in Katsina, same thing again, money was paid. In Kagara, the science secondary school, and even another one I think happened with commuters on the way. They were asking for, is it 500 million naira or so? That means half of a billion. So long as the government keeps on paying ransom to get students released, to get hostages released, the kidnappers will keep on kidnapping people. I think for once and for all, we should put a halt, you know, the issue of paying ransom to kidnappers, to criminals. We should put a halt to it, and we should use military force. And it's not all about using military force. I think the government should channel resources to prevention. Understand, the government cannot do it alone. The government security agencies, the police, as well as the army, how many are they? And in any case, this is the work of the police. But how many are they?
That was Dr. Abubakar Sani, public affairs analyst, speaking with reporter Mike Mbonye by phone from Maiduguri, Nigeria. The first vice president of Tanzania's Zanzibar Island died this morning, with speculation focusing on COVID-19 as the cause of death, even though the president denies the coronavirus is in the country. Saif Sharif Hamad, a prominent politician who was also the chairman of the Alliance for Change and Transparency Party, became the first person to declare his COVID-19 status in Tanzania since last April 29th, when he announced he was being hospitalized January 31st. No cause of death was announced. Zanzibar's president, Hussein Mwinyi, announced 7 days of national mourning period and flags will be flown at half staff. In South Africa, top members of the ruling African National Congress, or ANC, are hoping to meet with former President Jacob Zuma soon to try to avoid his arrest and possible imprisonment for defying a court order. Zuma's refusing to testify before a commission of inquiry that's probing corruption that happened when he led the country from 2009 to 2018. Lots of evidence has implicated Zuma in looting of state enterprises, evidence he dismisses as lies. Darren Taylor reports.
Zuma says commission leader Judge Raymond Zondo is biased and is a stooge of his political enemy and successor, President Cyril Ramaphosa.
As far as I am aware, there is no such evidence.
Prince Mashele is director of South Africa's Center for Politics and Research.
And I think there isn't, because even the person who's making the allegations, that is Jacob Zuma himself, has failed to produce evidence.
He says Zuma is trying to poison several key institutions.
He is trying to delegitimize the judiciary so that in the eyes of society, the judiciary is viewed as being biased and unfair against himself, Jacob Zuma. That's the first institution he wants to attack. The second institution is that of the state as a whole. The fact that he goes for the state president, accusing him of having collected bribes in order to win the elections in the ANC, he wants to delegitimize the president as someone who committed fraud all the way to the union buildings. So essentially, Jacob Zuma is trying to create a political crisis in order to escape his legal troubles.
Constitutional law expert Professor Pierre DeVos says going by the letter of the law, Zuma must go to jail if he refuses to testify.
If you are any person, whether you are a former president or whether you're somebody who has been ordered by the court to pay maintenance for your child, if you don't obey the court order, you are basically attacking the whole system, and it could lead to the collapse of the system. So it's very dangerous.
If any normal citizen flagrantly defied a court order, says DeVos, that person would already be in jail. But, of course, Zuma's not a normal citizen. He remains a leading member of the ruling party and still commands immense loyalty and support around the country, especially in his home province, KwaZulu-Natal, where his son, Edward Zuma, has told National TV his father will never appear before any commission.
Whatever decisions law enforcement agencies take, if ever they would want to arrest, incarcerate or imprison the former president, well, we are waiting for them, and we'll definitely give them a tough time in executing their duties if ever they take that particular decision.
Mashele asks, given this ongoing defiance in the Zuma camp and its threats, what's the point of the ANC's top six meeting Zuma?
He thinks that the ANC leadership is very weak. So this is a useless meeting in my view. Zuma has no respect for the ANC leadership, which is why he's attacking the party's president in that statement that he released yesterday.
The analyst says Zuma clearly believes he's too powerful to ever go to prison, both for refusing to testify at the inquiry and for the alleged corruption he committed when he was president.
We have a situation currently where you have an ex-president who is basically giving the state or our constitutional democracy the middle finger. He says to our constitutional system, there is nothing you can do to me.
Civil society groups are demanding that Zuma's bluff be called to show South Africans there's rule of law in the country, not rule by intimidation, subterfuge, and political gameplay. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
COVID-19 vaccinations kicked off today in South Africa after the first batch of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine arrived. Health workers are the first in the lineup, followed by the elderly, those with pre-existing conditions, then the rest of the population. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
The vaccination program commenced barely 24 hours after 8,000 doses of Johnson & Johnson vaccine arrived and immediately was distributed to 17 sites across the country. President Cyril Ramaphosa was one of the first in the queue. He urged all South Africans to emulate his example.
This day represents a real milestone for us as South Africans, that finally the vaccines are here. And I'd like to invite South Africans to take this up so that we can all be safe, we can all be healthy.
Sibongiseni Delihlazo is a representative of the Democratic Nursing Organization of South Africa.
A perfect time, I think, for the healthcare workers, especially those who are quite vulnerable, to be given a jab. So that could well be a proverbial calm, you know, before the next wave.
But not all frontline workers are happy. Some are worried by reports that the first batch is being used as an extension study while the government waits for the South African Health Products Regulatory Authority to license the vaccine. Rich Sicina is Secretary General of the Young Nurses Indaba Trade Union.
The problem is that there is no trust now between healthcare professionals, frontliners, and our government. It's worse when we are told that this vaccine will be rolled out or will be vaccinated in a trial study mode. And the biggest question we are asking is, why are we now used as guinea pigs?
An additional 500,000 doses are expected to arrive in the next few weeks, with a 9 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine expected in total. A total of 1.2 million frontline workers are expected to be inoculated before the vaccination program is extended to the rest of the population. The government swiftly turned to the Johnson & Johnson vaccine after studies revealed that the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine that had been ordered was not effective against the 501Y V2 variant dominant in South Africa. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
The terrorism trial of Paul Rasesbagina, Calixte Sankara, and 19 co-defendants started today in Rwanda's capital, Kigali. Rasesbagina, a leading critic of the Rwandan government, is internationally known for helping save hundreds of lives during the Rwandan genocide. Eugene Uimana has more from Kigali.
The case is being tried by the High Court Chamber for International and Cross-Border Crimes at the Supreme Court in Chimihurura. Because coronavirus restrictions limit the number of people in the court, officials made the proceedings available on video live stream. When he spoke, Professor Sabagina said he is a Belgian citizen and the court has no jurisdiction over him because he was abducted and brought to Rwanda. Speaking in Kinyarwanda, Rusesabagina says when he fled the country in 1996, he submitted his Rwandan ID card and passport. He says the United Nations recognized him as having no citizenship, and Belgium adopted him and issued him a Belgian ID and passport. He says he has never gotten his Rwandan citizenship back. Rusesabagina's lawyer, Gatera Gashabana, asked the court to send him to be tried in Belgium. Gashabana says, in their view, the prosecution has shown that Rusesabagina should be tried in Belgium because several years ago, prosecutors presented the case to Belgian judicial officials. The lead prosecutor is Angelique Habyarimana, Rwanda's deputy prosecutor general. She argued the government is prosecuting Rusesabagina as a Rwanda national who has another citizenship. Habyarimana says, regardless of the nationality, the laws are very clear. For a crime committed in Rwanda against Rwandans, Rwandan courts have jurisdiction to try that person. She says this should be clear. Paul Rusesabagina was arrested last August and has been heard without bail. His family says he was abducted and brought to Rwanda illegally. He was portrayed in the movie Hotel Rwanda for saving hundreds of lives during the 1994 genocide against the Tutsi. The United Nations say at least 800,000 people were killed. However, he has been a strong critic of President Paul Kagame, who has governed since 1994. Rusesabagina has ties to the National Liberation Front, or the FLN, an armed movement opposing Kagame. His co-defendant, Calixte Sankara, was arrested in 2019. Known as a spokesperson for the FLN, he's accused of having a role in attacks in Rwanda. The president's supporters credit him with rebuilding the country economically and keeping the peace, but critics say he rules through fear and crushes opposition. The hearing today drew the attention of many, including some diplomats who were at the court. The issue of citizenship and court jurisdiction took most of the first day of proceedings, and the judges warned the trial may take a long time because there are many suspects on trial and because 84 victims who are claiming reparations will be heard. The next session will be on February 26, when the court will announce its ruling on its jurisdiction. Jean Wimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
On the 10th anniversary today of Libya's revolution, residents are cautiously optimistic as the UN-sponsored Libyan political dialogue agreed to an interim authority to oversee an effort to rebuild the state institutions leading to national elections late this year. Assam Omish, president of the Libyan American Alliance, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi about prospects of success and challenges facing the agreement.
I think even the most optimist amongst us is worried. I think the chances for success, given all the circumstances, and really given also the fact that the government, the interim government, our authority that was agreed upon in the Libyan political dialogue, really is not equipped with the strongest credentials to address the most critical issues, whether that's the issue of Haftar and his military presence in the east, or whether it's the issue of the strong and deep militias in Libya, the divisions of the country. And so, I think there is a renewed hope, there is a renewed interest, and there is definitely a renewed international will to see to it that these things get resolved. But I believe the interim authority that was elected does not have all the highest level credentials to be able to deliver. We are hopeful that the Libyan people's will to see a change will bring about. Hopefully the savviness of the technocrats and the businessmen who are in charge of the government will allow for an involvement and inclusion of everybody and some will to overcome problems. And hopefully a head of a presidential council from the east who has not been involved with the blood and the war of the Haftar incursions on Tripoli will have the credentials to be able to create national reconciliation and bring back unity between east and west and south. So we're hopeful. I think the circumstances we're looking at is an increased and a continued will by the international community to see to it that everybody who signed up for this roadmap sticks to their end of the bargain. We need an end of the proxy intervention. We need to see a follow-up to the arms embargo by the UN. And we need to see that economic mechanisms have put in place to alleviate the pressure on the Libyan population and at the same time give incentives to those who may want war to stay away from it so that Libya can prosper and come together.
What is the Libyan American Alliance doing to get more U.S. support for a political solution in Libya?
So the Libyan American Alliance, as it has in the past, has continued to work on multiple levels of political advocacy, public diplomacy, as well as community engagement to get the Libyan Americans involved in influencing policy and bringing about change in Libya. But more specifically, as of the beginning of the new administration, we have drafted a white paper, a policy paper that is comprehensive and that covers all aspects of what we believe should be guidelines for the U.S. policy in Libya. We are in the final stages of completing the co-authorship of it because we engaged significant Libya experts and U.S. politicians to contribute to it. And then we're going to engage a process of briefings as well as engagement with the policymakers to hopefully put forth a comprehensive a vision for a successful Libya out of this difficulties. We're continuing to work with Congress to ensure that the Libya Stabilization Act is coming through. And we're continuing to engage the Libyan American community through different means. Some of it is educational, some of it is economic, in order to ensure that we're building the byproducts of the stability that Libya, which hopefully we'll have soon, so that we can sustain and continue the success of this transition, God willing.
That was Esham Omish, president of the Libyan American Alliance, speaking to VOA's Mohammed Al-Shanawi. Meanwhile, Reuters reports that Egypt is planning to reopen its embassy in Libya's capital for the first time in 6 years, marking a shift to a more conciliatory approach to Western Libya-based factions. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 1705 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music from Bobo Music to Hip Life, Bonga Flavor to Sukus, Afrobeat to Ndombolo and Makosa to Kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after